Well, good morning. Thank you all for being here and thankful to God for all of you and for your prayers. Thankful for the blessing of the Chipman family and God's goodness to them as we heard about and their return safely back home and seeing friends back in town and visitors and others. We are thankful to God for all these great blessings that are ours in Him. Today I wanted to think about, since it's maybe a little bit different, it's kind of a broad idea. I hope to make sense of the great privilege that we have as Christians and to encourage you and make some application too. We're going to think about the reality of reality of who God is, of Jesus Christ. We'll be thinking about idol worship. We'll think about who we are in Christ, and even make some application with regard to our gatherings as believers and even with outreach and things like that. Thinking about the finality of Christianity and the worship of the saints, I've gone back and forth so many times on what to call this, and I didn't want to make it so broad that we don't make sense of anything. But at the same time, I don't want to make it so narrow that it only applies to maybe a few of us or something. But the idea that I'm thinking about really kind of emerges from what we've been doing in our Master's Community Groups, where when we went through the book of Jude, at the end of Jude's letter, there is a doxology there in verses 24 and 25. And from that, we have, in the past several weeks, been looking at what are thought of to be hymns and songs, hymn fragments, doxologies, and creeds that are seen in the New Testament. These texts that seem to be expressions, some pre-composed ideas that the writers of the New Testament will use. And it got me to thinking about ways in which these things are used, Christian creativity, as it were, used in a way to exalt in God and to express doctrine or even to share the gospel, perhaps in a creedal sort of form. And it got me to thinking about that, how Christian creativity was employed to help early believers to worship God, to serve one another and to serve our neighbors and friends and to witness to them as well. And so the proposition here is, because we are in the end times, we are this group, as Paul says, the end of the ages has come upon us. That's who we are as the body of Christ. Proposition is this, that Christian worship, musical or otherwise, being rooted in the person and work of Christ, is a response to the beauty of God and is the fulfillment of the religious longings of both Jews and Gentiles. Let me say that again. Christian worship, musical or otherwise, being rooted in the person and work of Christ, is a response to the beauty of God and is the fulfillment of the religious longings of both Jews and Gentiles. Christianity is this fulfillment religion. Okay? Well, we can think of this kind of, if we kind of think about like the history of mankind and how we know that man is sort of incurably religious. You could listen to, say, teachers like R.C. Sproul, or if you read about even atheists like Friedrich Nietzsche or something, they recognize that we have within us this religious bent. Whether we know God or not, it's in us. And so all through history, you can see this kind of parallel activity of religious activity, both, say, on the Jewish side and the Gentile or pagan side of things happening at the same time. Well, the Jews, of course, had this religion of Judaism that was revealed to them by God. They had Torah, which sort of regulated all of their activity as the people of God. Pagans, on the other hand, they only had what came from their own imaginations, what was maybe stamped on them as image bearers of God, but they didn't have any kind of regulating sort of principles like the Jews had through Torah. They were left up to themselves. And so we see then how Christianity, at least for Torah, for the Jewish side of things, we understand very readily that Christianity is a fulfillment of that. We see it all over the New Testament. And so we can even see, like in our text this morning, Hebrews chapter 1, if you'll turn there, Hebrews 1, verses 1 to 4. You probably have this memorized. This is an expression of the person of Jesus Christ and who He is, and the writer of Hebrews takes that and just launches into the superiority of Christ, the finality of who He is and His work, and the importance of that, and how really we are all humans, whether Jew or Gentile, really, we belong to Him, but it is only through Him that we can be made right with God. Hebrews 1, 1-4, he says, "Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days He has spoken to us by His Son, whom He has appointed the heir of all things, through whom also He created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature, and He upholds the universe by the word of His power. After making purification for sins, He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become as much superior to angels as the name He has inherited is more excellent than theirs." Now, we may think because Hebrews is addressing Jewish Christians that when we read something like this, we understand that, well, of course, He's a fulfillment of all these Old Testament expectations. We see that all throughout the New Testament. We see Luke, in Luke's Gospel in chapter 24, you remember after the resurrection, Jesus, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, began to explain to them everything in the Scriptures concerning Himself. You see also in John's Gospel, in his prologue, John 1, 1 through 18, where he's picking up on the form of the book of Genesis. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and so on. But he also talks about He came and He dwelt among us, picking up on the language of Exodus chapter 33. So much of that is echoed in John's Gospel. But what's interesting is he's also kind of giving a nod to this Gentile or philosophical idea of the Logos, that in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. For the philosophers, they understood this Logos, this abstract thing, as this principle that governs the universe. John says this principle is Jesus Christ. He is the one that organizes the universe and makes sense of the reality that you experience. Okay? Well, we see this over and over in the New Testament. Paul in Romans 10, that Jesus Christ is the end of the law for righteousness. For the Jews, the law was their righteousness. If you read Deuteronomy 6, verse 25, that the law was their righteousness. Jesus is the end of that. He is its goal. He is its culmination. Well, then, if all these things are true about Jews, then what about Gentiles? I mean, we understand from Paul's own writings even that we're the far-off ones. What about them? What about the pagan religion? Is there nothing to that? Why were they so bent on worshiping their ideas and projecting their ideas on some image? Well, in this way, C.S. Lewis can help us. I recently finished a book that was written by Alistair McGrath. He's an Oxford scholar who actually did a biography on Lewis, and he wrote this book called The Intellectual World of C.S. Lewis. And so one of the things that C.S. Lewis learned, you may know, if you know much about the life of C.S. Lewis, there was this rather fateful evening in September of 1931 where he and J.R.R. Tolkien, the great, you know, author of The Lord of the Rings, and another man named Hugo Dyson were speaking to one another, and they talked about the idea of myth and what a myth was. See, Lewis and Tolkien were both these experts in, like, medieval literature, and Lewis became rather, he is recognized as this scholar with regard to these kinds of ideas that were present in medieval, literature and ideas and stuff. And so, quoting from McGrath on this idea, what about these pagan religions, these myths, and so on? So here's what C.S. Lewis came to say. McGrath says about Lewis. He says, Lewis came to see that myths possess an innate capacity to expand the consciousness and imagination of their readers. A myth awakens imaginatively a longing for something that lies beyond the grasp of reason. Like Tolkien, Lewis came to hold that myths offered a, quote, real though unfocused gleam of divine truth falling on the human imagination, unquote. Christianity, rather than being one myth alongside many others, is thus to be seen as representing the fulfillment of all myths, the true myth toward which all other myths merely point. Christianity thus tells a true story about humanity, which makes sense of all the stories that humanity tells about itself. That's an interesting insight. In fact, that's exactly what the writer of Hebrews says was true of Judaism. What Christianity does for Judaism, it also really does for paganism in that way. He says that one of Lewis's most significant insights concerning the grand themes of the Christian narrative is that if ever there were a myth to be realized in historical time and space, quote, it would be just like this. That's why we can see many naysayers will talk about Christianity borrowing from all these other religions. You know, you have these ideas of a God that is born and even dies and rises. You can hear that in like Zoroastrianism. You can see in other religions where there's a creation narrative or the idea of a flood. You've probably read about that. There are these ancient mythological texts that say similar things. Where do they get this stuff? How do they say similar things that the Bible says? Well, a lot of naysayers will say, well, the Bible, see, is just borrowing that. It's just human writing. The difference between Christianity and those things is that, like Lewis points out, is that this is true. It really happened. You have history backing up what you and I believe in. I think that's wonderful. He says, the decisive insight was that Christianity was not a set of doctrines and moral principles, but a controlling grand narrative, a myth in the true sense of the term, which generated and sustained such ideas and values. The story of Christ was thus a true myth, that is to say, a myth which functions in the same manner as other myths, yet which really happened. Christianity possessed the literary form of a myth, where the critical difference was that it was true. The story of Christ is thus to be understood as, quote, God's myth, where the great pagan narratives are men's myths. So, we can even see in the New Testament where the Bible speaks to the idea of why Gentiles do what they do in their worship. Classic example would be in Acts chapter 17 when Paul goes to Athens and he speaks to the philosophers at the Areopagus. He is agitated in his heart by all of the idol worship that's going on and picks up on the one that says to an unknown God. And he says, you know what? This unknown God that you're trying to honor, I'll tell you about it. And you know what he says. He says, God is not one who dwells in temples made with hands. Doesn't that sound very similar to what the writer of Hebrews says? Nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life and breath. In all things. The divine nature is not to be considered like something made out of gold or silver, fashioned from man's art and imagination. It's exactly what Lewis noticed about these pagan myths. And that's what Paul is saying here to the philosophers in Athens. And then, of course, when he talks about a judgment that would come, well, then they mock it. Paul says, well, he has fixed a day where he will judge every man, and he's proven it by the resurrection of Christ. And that's huge. Obviously, that makes a big difference. We see Paul also echoing this idea in Romans 1, verses 18 to 25. And we even talked about this morning. This is one of the pernicious, incipient and insipid problems of the human heart, of always trying to exchange the glory of a created thing, exchange the glory of God for a created thing. In Romans 1, verse 23, he says, the invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. Although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened, claiming to be wise. They became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. We understand this. This is one of those things where Paul is saying this is why man is in such a terrible predicament before a holy God, because he turns what really properly belongs to God and makes him worthy of our praise and adoration, we turn it towards something created. We'll think about a little more of this. Lewis understands that Christianity as that which is real, and it is the only view that can actually allow for both true and false ideas about God. I'll explain that. Where myths do not allow for what is true. This is an interesting thing. Lewis wrote a poem, or not a poem, he wrote an essay called Is Theology Poetry? And he spoke at what was called the Socratic Society in Oxford. And he explains, you might pick up on the really famous quote by Lewis at the very end here. But he talks about the difference between the truth of Christianity and the falsehood of, really he's talking about science and naturalism and how science and that whole view of the universe is really false. It's another form of idolatry, to be quite honest. That's what we're talking about here. And so everywhere you hear the word science, think of the idea of myth or idol worship, okay? So I'll quote, this is the last part of this little thing from Lewis. Listen to this. He says, this is how I distinguish dreaming and waking. He says, when I am awake, I can in some degree account for and study my dream. The dragon that pursued me last night can be fitted into my waking world. I know that there are such things as dreams. I know that I had eaten an indigestible dinner. I know that a man of my reading might be expected to dream of dragons. But while in the nightmare, I could not have fitted my waking experience. The waking world is judged more real because it can thus contain the dreaming world. The dreaming world is judged less real because it cannot contain the waking one. For the same reason, I am certain that in passing from the scientific points of view to the theological, I passed from dream to waking. Christian theology can fit in science, art, morality, and the sub-Christian religions. The scientific or mythical point of view cannot fit in any of these, not even science itself. I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I can see it, but because by it I see everything else. That's the difference between Christianity and all these other false religious systems. That it can actually fit in the false ideas about God into our understanding of who Christ is and what he has accomplished in redemption. But those others can't. Why is it that none of those religions have the idea of an atonement? Of the idea of a God that becomes a man as as offensive as that might be to their own sensibilities, nevertheless, Christianity says that and more. That God not only is incarnate, he died for you and me, for his rebels, against, for his own enemies, he died for them. So thus we see that Judaism, at least in this sense, is the more awake religion, right? Because it was actually given by God. It was reality for the Jews. But it actually made sense of not only the truth of who God was for them, but it also comprehended the false ideas of the pagan nations around them. But it's not as though the pagans didn't have any ideas that were true about God. There were ideas that were true. They were just approached the wrong way. So we see that for the Jews, Torah was this controlling worldview to make sense of reality, whereas for Gentiles, myth was the worldview. And it's as though both streams converged onto the person and work of Jesus Christ, where he fulfills them and outshines both of them. It's as though he is the fullness of what man is longing for and then sets it aside on those false ways or incomplete ways of approaching him. So, compared to both Judaism and pagan myths, Christianity stands alone. It is uniquely fit as the only faith based on the truth of God. And it is the only one that has an atonement, a true atonement for sin, and makes us righteous before a holy God. And so, in saying this about paganism, by the way, I don't want to give the idea that we're trying to endorse false religion in any way. No. Even though there may be true ideas about God in these false religions, they're a false religion. God's a jealous God, and he will not compete with some other false deity that man makes up. And so we can see how for both Jews and Gentiles, there are numerous texts actually in the New Testament that points to the gospel and the reality of Christianity that really lays to rest what man was doing, both in Judaism and in paganism. You say, like in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 18 to 24, Paul says that the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, for it is the power of God for salvation. And he says, then he quotes, he says, where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? God has made foolish the wisdom of man. That man thinking that he is approaching God through his own way, God actually turns that into foolishness. And so he's really addressing both Jews and Gentiles. He's saying, where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? The scribe would have been the expert in the law. He would have known Torah. He would have been able to tell him everything about who this God was. The difference is the similarity, between both what was going on in Corinth at the time with the philosophers and the scribes and so on, is both of them are trying to size up Jesus Christ. They're both trying to domesticate him in a way that says, okay, he says Jews seek signs and the Greeks seek wisdom. Well, the Jews are saying, prove to us you are who you say you are. Prove to us that we can trust in you, that you are in fact the Messiah. Or the wise man, the philosopher, he would be, he's seeking wisdom. What can you tell us that makes us understand the world better? In either case, Jesus Christ is showing them, I'm not your pet. I am not one you can domesticate and control, and you possess me as your own. I made you. So, we ask the question then, why do people invent idols and myths? What is it about them? What is this? It seems to be this mysterious thing. What's this psychology, as it were, that drives idol worship? We know that both Jews and Gentiles are guilty of idolatry. Paul makes the case clearly, Romans 1 to 3. He says that we judge that all men are sinners, both Jews and Gentiles. Jews had an advantage, but they were not better off. He says that. So at the heart of false religion is two things. One, it is the worship of a false god or gods, or it is the wrong worship of the true God. It is worship of a false god or gods, or it is the wrong worship of the true God. Okay? Both of which are the result of what man wrongly imagines about God. Well, like we know from Romans 1, that man can see things in creation, and through his observation and imagination, he recasts what he thinks is beautiful into something he can make for himself to give him significance and security. Guys, this is the problem with our hearts when it comes to sin. It is that. It is that. And for non-believers, it is that. You take what you think is beautiful and you recast it in an image that you use for yourself, for your own significance. Oh, I want an identity. I want a place in the world. I want to feel secure about what's going to come and have a sense of peace in the world. Every person has that kind of longing. They want to feel important. They want to have an identity. But the problem is they're taking what rightly belongs to God and they're trying to use it for their own end. That's the problem. So Lewis declares this. Here we go again. He declares that human beings construct myths because they're meant to. They have been created by God with the innate capacity to create myths as echoes of a greater story, a story of a larger kind. In that human beings bear God's image, human beings are endowed with the Creator's capacity to create in a suitably accommodated and reduced manner. Human beings are thus sub-creators, empowered and envisioned to create art, culture, technology, including literature, particularly myth and fantasy, as we find in fairy tales. When a story maker creates a believable world, Tolkien remarks, what really happens is that he proves to be a successful sub-creator. He makes a secondary world in which your mind can enter. Inside it, what he relates is true. It accords with the laws of that world. You therefore believe it while you are, as it were, inside. And so you create these stories. And that's how we know about, like, all of the religions of ancient Egypt, or in the ancient Near East, all of these hill gods, the Baal and Molech and Dagon and so forth, they learn about what these gods were like from these quote-unquote mythological texts that exist from the ancient world. And we learn about them, and it's this constant battle of ideas of the true God being funneled into a wrong idea about him. And they make an image and they say, oh, that's God. It's like the golden calf incident, only for Gentiles. God is a jealous God. Another writer, talking about creation and the beauty in creation, he says that creation is charged with divine beauty because the Creator is at work through His Spirit, bringing things to their proper end in relation to the Father through the Son. And he talks about how Jesus Christ is even the end and the goal of creation. That's what happens. Even we read that in Revelation. You see that in Romans chapter 8. It was subjected to futility, but it is ultimately fulfilled, and its purposes are fulfilled in Jesus Christ. He also, this other author says, beauty elicits desire, a desire to dwell with and enjoy that which we experience as beautiful. And so this idea of idolatry really seems to emerge from that kind of a thing about what a person sees as beautiful, whether it's an idea they see about the power of nature or the beauty perhaps of life from life, like a mother giving birth, or even acts of kindness and goodness to another person. They'll take these ideas, sort of abstract them, and then project it onto some image that they create, and they say, that's your God. That's what God's like right there. See that? It's like an animal. It could be a cow or a lion, you know. And we even use images like that symbolically to tell ourselves, you know, this is what God's like. He's like a lion, not a tame lion, right? And so we pick up on these images because there is something in creation that does speak about the greatness and the wonder and the power of our God. This writer says, the biblical idea of idolatry and imaging in idolatry, he says, is fundamentally a relational term, one with a particular relationship in view. It draws attention away to the way in which the image reflects the original as its primary relation. He says this, the image is like a shadow dependent upon the object it reflects, right? So you make an image, you say this is what that image is about. Well, that image is dependent on the thing you're saying that it is, all right? Nothing new there. But he says it is this imaging relationship that is the primary vantage point of Scripture. In other words, the image is not necessarily the big deal. It's the relationship the worshiper has to that. That's the big deal. And that's what God claims as his, as rightfully belonging to him. He says this, the image of God in us is constituted by a yearning for satisfaction or fulfillment in that relation. The intrinsic desire for fulfillment is hardwired into the human person. It's in our heart. That idea of having significance. It is precisely this yearning for completion that draws humans into relationships and makes those relationships fragile and open to corruption. He says, genuine worship is giving yourself to the living God in whom and for whom you have been created. Idolatry, by contrast, is substituting the true object of worship for an imitation and reorienting that relationship from worship to possession. In other words, it's, again, man creating an idea for himself that he can pour himself into that gives him significance and gives him a sense of identity. Tim Keller is great about saying this, where, you know, it could be anything from your career, could be the pursuit of maybe an education or a relationship with another person. The problem is this. He says, those who create an idol seek to possess it for their own purpose. An idol is desired as a means to an end, and the end is significance and security on the individual's own terms. But a strange reality sets in with idols. Since significance and security cannot be fulfilled by the idol creates a deeper longing for significance and security for which it cannot provide. Effectively, the idol possesses the one who fashioned it and leads to a deeper dissatisfaction and a greater frustration. It would be as though you have a spouse in a room who happens to be a great artist. And this great artist paints a wonderful picture for you, a picture for you to enjoy and remind you of them. But instead of loving that artist, you fall in love with the picture that they made. And they sit ignored all the time by your heart being poured into the painting instead of the person. That's at the heart of idolatry. And you know what? If you don't know Jesus Christ, if you don't understand that he is the one who fulfills ultimately all of your longings, you know what? You're no better than the suicide bomber who thinks that he's going to heaven by pouring his life into those ideas. Do you think you're better off? You're not as bad outwardly. You're not as immoral as them. Or you maybe don't live in a philosophical world that would justify that kind of behavior, but you're no better off. That's what Paul says. Even the Jews who had the law, they had an advantage, but they were not better off. They were using Torah really as their God, thinking they were in. Many of them were, I should say. Not all, of course. We know there are those who live by faith, Hebrews 11. But the writer of Hebrews points to Jesus Christ. He is the image. He is the one who is the exact representation of this divine nature. Colossians 1 says that. So, what does all this have to do with Christian worship? Well, as Christian image bearers, we have the ability to create beautiful things, to use them as a means of honoring God, to reflect something of His goodness and beauty and truth, and to make good on declaring His excellencies. Everything within the spheres of speaking and serving, like Peter says in 1 Peter 4, everything from musical worship to preaching to evangelism, ministry to the poor, ministry to the sick or marginalized, all of this is done as an outworking of our ability to create ways to do that. I mean, we were even talking about this just last week. You know, how can we get people to believe the gospel? How can we, you know, form relationships with non-believers and stuff like that? You know, it's ways that we're trying to exercise our creative ability to hopefully show people who Jesus Christ is. Because Christianity is this fulfillment of true religion, it has an interesting twist, though. There are no longer any special religious objects or places or temples or images or people. We don't have that as Christianity anymore. Isn't that funny? All these religions had their temples and so on. The writer of Hebrews, very fascinating, using the idea of the temple itself or the tabernacle, he compares that with the flow of redemptive history. Let's look in Hebrews chapter 9 real quick. Verses 8 through 14. Hebrews 9, 8 to 14. This is interesting because he's talking about the tabernacle and the difference between that which was going on earth, that which was made with hands, versus what Jesus Christ does in the true tabernacle in heaven. He says this, verse 8, "By this the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the holy place is not yet opened as long as the first section is still standing, which is symbolic for the present age. According to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices are offered that cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper, but deal only with food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of the Reformation. But when Christ appeared as high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing eternal redemption. For if the sprinkling of defiled persons with the blood of the goats and bulls and with the ashes of a heifer sanctifies for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" He's comparing the image of the temple with this flow of history. It's as though you're walking through the temple, and as you're going through the holy place, you know, there was the outer court. You go into the doors, and there's the holy place that had the table of the showbread. It had a basin, a wash basin, and it had the menorah. You remember that? And so it's as though in the old covenant, under the old way, it's as though you were walking through that. And then you reach this other thing of curtains. That's the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And you enter through that curtain, through his body, to get to him. He is the one where his presence dwelt there. And that's the idea of history, that in Christianity, we have entered the Holy of Holies. Now, it's not ultimate yet. We don't have the new heavens and new earth yet, but it's been inaugurated. We're in it. We're in it, but not quite fully in that sense. So the writer of Hebrews even makes that case. So, you know, no longer, though, even though all these religious systems have temples and people and ideas and stuff that were physical objects, we don't have that. That's interesting. You would think the fulfillment religion would have the best version of it, but we don't have any of it. Listen to this. Hebrews says, 12:28, "Therefore let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe." And then he says in chapter 13, verse 15, "Through him, then, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of the lips that acknowledge His name. Where the religions of Judaism and paganism regard the importance of sacred spaces and people, John Piper said this, "The New Testament shows a stunning degree of indifference to worship as an outward form and a radical intensification of worship as an inward experience of the heart." We see this in John chapter 4 with Jesus and the Samaritan woman. He says the hour is coming when neither on this mountain or in Jerusalem that you'll worship the Father, right? He says those who the Father is seeking true worshipers, that the hour has come and now is when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. The Father is seeking such people to worship Him. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth. So, worship is significantly de-institutionalized, de-localized, de-externalized. The whole thrust is taken off of ceremony and seasons and places and forms and is being shifted to what is happening in the heart. Not just on Sunday, but every day and all the time in all of life. So, Jesus Christ, who is the exact imprint of God's nature, He is the radiance of God's glory. He upholds all things by His powerful word. He is the image of the invisible God, Colossians 1 says. We, like we just read in Colossians 2, are filled to the full in Him. No religion can say that their God, that the fullness of deity dwells in Him bodily. You won't read that in the Old Testament. There are hints there, yes, yes. But they didn't have that. They were still looking. So when we as the fulfillment people of God are like priests, we are a kingdom of priests. So when we gather for worship in our preaching and singing and fellowship and praying, we are declaring the excellencies of Christ to one another. That's why our worship gatherings are so important. And so Paul tells us to sing psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, making melody in your heart to the Lord. He says also that in our singing and so forth, we are teaching and admonishing one another. So then what about outreach? Since we're in outreach season, this is the very idea that Peter is picking up on. Because we are this chosen people, this royal priesthood, a people of God's own possession, this kingdom of priests, we are to declare the excellencies of Christ to the lost. They are non-believers, but they bear God's image. And there's something about Him that they understand and that they want. They just go about it the wrong way. And in some cases, of course, they pervert it, terribly so. But as a kingdom of priests, we tell them, Jesus Christ is the only one that can bring you significance. So, in the only images that we have, as it were, the only actions in terms of liturgy that God has ordained as a significant thing is really baptism and the Lord's Supper. That's ultimately it. It's not that there is something magical that necessarily happens, but for us there is great blessing. Because in the Lord's Supper, what is comprehended in this meal is the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and also the incarnation. Because the fullness of God became a person, and that person offered Himself for you and me. That's why it's so significant. And if you don't believe that, this is really, to partake of something like this would really be something of an act of judgment on yourself. Because you don't believe it, you reject it. The thing God says is great, it's no big deal. A chip and a sip, they might say. So, as we come to this point, we recognize God is the one who is the fulfillment of all of our longings, ultimately. And we look to Him to fulfill us. But we do it on His terms, not on our own. That's why we need the gospel, and we preach it to ourselves constantly. So if the men have been asked to serve and the chorale come up, let's partake together. proclaiming his death until he comes as we partake.